Sounds difficult. Interesting, Yamagata corrected. An interesting challenge. Brad nodded. We will have to implant communications equipment, probably in your skull. Implant? Brad asked. You mean surgically? Of course. Professor Kossoff wants full-time recording of everything you see and hear. He stepped up to Brad and peered closely at his face. We will replace one of your eyes with a minicam. Take one of my eyes? Brad yelped. Smiling slightly, Yamagata said, We will store it for you, and return it to its proper residence once you have returned to the ship. Brad tried not to wince. Yes, Yamagata hissed. And an oral implant. That can go into your ear channel. Plus two-way communications, of course.
Of course, said Brad. I wouldn't want to be cut off from MC.
Yamagata's smile widened. I can guarantee you at least one thing, Dr. McDaniels.
What is it?
You are going to lose weight.
Preparations.
Felicia walked beside Brad's gurney as it guided itself toward the surgical center. She looked grim, tight-lipped. Already slightly woozy from the preoperative sedation, he reached out and clutched her hand.
Don't be mad at me.
Her eyes widened with surprise.
Mad at you? I'm not mad at you.
You're not happy.
Oh, Brad, you...
The doors to the operating room swung open automatically, but the gurney stopped itself. No visitors allowed beyond this point, it announced flatly. Felicia leaned over Brad's supine body and kissed him.
I'll be waiting for you, darling.
Yeah, he mumbled. Me too.
I love you.
Me too.
Brad awoke and saw Felicia drowsing in a big cushioned chair at the side of his bed. He was in one of the infirmary's recovery rooms. It was small but neat, clean and bright, smelling faintly of antiseptics and flowers. A row of diagnostic machines lined one wall, but they were silent. No beeps or hums. He felt no pain, but everything seemed slightly fuzzy, out of focus. They've screwed up my eyes, he thought. He blinked a few times, and his vision cleared somewhat. But it was different somehow. Okay, he told himself. Your left eye has been replaced by a miniaturized camera. Dr. Yamagata said it's sending signals through my optic nerve just the way my real eye did, so I've still got stereoscopic vision. But it wasn't quite the same. Somehow his vision seemed sharper, he realized. He focused on the far wall of the room and could make out tiny cracks in the plastic facing that were invisible when he closed his left eye. I'm a lot better than 20/20 now, he realized. No pain, although he felt slightly dopey, slow-witted. He raised his right hand and started counting the pale blonde hairs along his fingers.
You're awake.
Felicia was staring at him.
Hi.
She got up from the chair and took his face in both her hands.
You're awake,
she repeated breathlessly. How do I look?
Fine.
My new eye?
It looks just like your old one, she said, smiling happily.
He wrapped an arm around her neck, pulled her to him, and they kissed. Then he heard the door open. Felicia straightened up, and Brad saw Dr. Yamagata stride into the room, peering at him intently. He must have been watching me, Brad thought, although he couldn't see a surveillance camera anywhere in the small room. How do you feel? Yamagata asked.
Okay.
A little dull, sort of. That's the anesthetics. It takes an hour or two for the nervous system to fully recuperate from the electrical blocks.
Felicia asked, Is he all right?
Grinning broadly, the physician replied, Your husband was an ideal patient. Everything went quite smoothly. His new eye is transmitting quite clearly to the monitoring system.
Brad realized what that meant.
It's transmitting everything? Everything you see, said Yamagata. In a few days, we will implant the oral transmitter in your ear. Then we will receive everything you hear as well.
I won't have any privacy at all.
Not while you have the implants in you. You will have guardian angels with you at every moment.
30 million clicks away, Brad knew.
He glanced at Felicia. Instead of looking distressed, she seemed almost mischievously cheery.
You'll have to keep your eyes closed in bed, she said with a giggle.
Brad thought,
And we'll have to keep damned quiet, too. Now I know what it's like to be in the army, in basic training, Brad complained. The 2 months after his surgery had been spent in survival training and stuffing every bit of knowledge about conditions on Gamma's surface into Brad's brain. Yamagata and his surgical team had implanted a communications link that connected Brad to MC with the speed of light. Still, Kossoff, Little John, and every other department head tried to pour all their specialized knowledge into Brad's brain. And Kossoff insisted that Brad take a course in survival. The ship's auditorium was converted into a virtual reality simulation of Gamma's surface, with utterly realistic-looking trees and rocks, and even streams gurgling past Brad's booted feet. Tifa Valente drove Brad mercilessly through the simulated wilderness. Whenever he complained about the rigors of the training, she would reply urgently, "This could be the difference between life and death for you, Brad. You've got to learn to live with the planet's environment. We won't be there to rescue you if you fall into a puddle of quicksand." "There isn't any quicksand on Gamma," he grumbled.
"None that we've discovered," Tifa countered. "Yet."
So, day after day, Brad plowed through survival training, learning how to keep himself alive on the surface of Gamma. "I'm not going to be alone down there," he pointed out to Tifa one afternoon as they took a break for tea. "The whole idea of this mission is to make contact with the aliens." The cafeteria was half empty. Tifa had walked them to a small table far from the dispensing machines where people pulled their choices of food and drink. Not even the serving robots came near their table. Her long face totally serious, she said, "Those aliens might not like having a stranger suddenly invade their territory. You might have to run for your life." Groaning inwardly at the thought of adding wind sprints to his training, Brad replied with equal seriousness, "They're not violent. We haven't seen one single act of violent behavior."
"And how many scenes of having a human burst in on them have we seen?" she countered.
Brad shrugged. Tifa looked determined, unyielding. Her deep violet eyes were staring at him. He saw that tears were welling in them.
"Brad," she said, her voice low, throaty, "if anything happened to you, I..."
He sat across the table from her, dumbfounded. She lowered her eyes, murmuring,
"You look and look and look. Then when you find the man you want, he's already married."
"Tifa, I had no idea. I mean, I never thought..."
"It's all right."
She tried to smile.
"You just make sure you get back here in one piece. Don't you make a widow out of Felicia. She's too nice a kid for that."
Brett grabbed his teacup and took a long swallow. In the self-heated cup, the tea was burning hot. He gulped and choked and tried not to cough. Tifa pushed her chair back and got up from the table.
"I'll see you in the VR sim," she said, then hurried away.
Objections. Kossoff was smoldering. Thumping his fingers angrily on the conference table, he practically snarled, "This is a hell of a time to bring up such objections." The meeting of the science staff's department chiefs fell absolutely silent. Kossoff had called the meeting for a final check from each department for their approvals to send Brad to the surface of Gamma. Now, seated at the head of the table, he glared at Quentin Abbott, the chief of the astronomy department. Abbott exuded Englishness. Brad, at the foot of the conference table, thought that the astronomer could not have looked more English if he were wearing a derby hat and a monocle. Abbott was slim, his thin face sculpted with prominent cheekbones, a finely arched nose, and a long pointy jaw. His carefully brushed hair was silver-gray, as was his tidy little mustache. Like everyone else along the table, he wore a comfortable tunic and slacks, but on him, somehow, the clothes looked almost like a Savile Row morning suit. His bright blue eyes could sparkle, but at the moment they were staring back at Kossoff almost defiantly. "Can't be helped, I'm afraid," he said, quite undaunted by Kossoff's ire.
"Facts, you know, are facts."
"But we're practically ready to send our contact man to Gamma," Kossoff objected, jabbing a finger toward Brad. "Our man is prepared to go to the surface and make physical contact with the aliens." Clasping his hands together on the tabletop as if he were about to pray, Abbott said quite calmly, "You cannot stop the coming conjunction of the planet with Beta, no more than King Canute could stop the tide from coming in." And you believe that conditions on the planet will become dangerous?
Dangerous? Abbott almost laughed.
They'll be catastrophic. You won't be able to keep this ship in orbit around Gamma while Beta speeds past. Tidal surges will be enormous. The entire planet will be swept by storms and upheavals of biblical proportions.
Why didn't you tell us of this earlier? Kossoff demanded.
Very calmly, Abbott replied.
Because we didn't know about it earlier. We'd done some preliminary calculations, of course, but the closer we looked at the conditions when the two planets meet, the more catastrophic the effects, we realized.
It took you more than a year to realize this?
I'm afraid so. Extraordinary situation, you realize. Awfully sorry we couldn't scope out the details earlier, of course.
From the foot of the table, Brad said, but the Gammons survived the two planets meeting. Abbott turned his fine-featured face in Brad's direction.
Yes, they do, apparently. And then the planet swings away from Mithra and starts its long winter season.
And the Gammons survive that, too, Brad pointed out.
Somehow, Abbott conceded.
Then if I'm down on the surface with them, I can survive the conjunction along with them.
Rather chancy, I'd say.
Anything they can do, I can do, Brad insisted. Kossoff raised a stubby finger. But you won't have the rest of us in orbit around Gamma. We'll have to move this ship to Alpha, with all of us in it.
Brad said, that's still only about 3 minutes away. I'll still be able to talk with you and with MC.
In his softly courteous tone, Captain Desai pointed out, 3 minutes can be very critical in an emergency situation. It can be a lifetime. The difference between life and death.
I'm willing to risk it, Brad replied. In fact, I'm eager to see how the Gammons get themselves through the crisis.
The others around the table fell silent. They all turned toward Kossoff, waiting for him to make a decision.
We actually don't have much time to waste, Kossoff said as if thinking aloud. We've already used up more than a year. We'll have to return to Earth in a little less than 4 years.
Abbott interjected. That's still plenty of time.
Kossoff cut him off. No, it's not plenty of time. Do you think it's enough time to do the job, Dr. Littlejohn?
Looking startled, Littlejohn replied. Enough time to make meaningful contact with the Gammons, tell them of the Death Wave, and convince them to let us install the shielding equipment?
Barely.
And we'll have to test the shields before we leave, the chief engineer added.
Abbott suggested, you could put in a call to the World Council's mission controllers, see what they think about all this.
Call Earth, Kossoff snapped.
On the FTL system. You could thrash this out with them in a few days. After all, they are supposed to be in control of this mission.
You don't have to take the responsibility for this decision on your own shoulders, old man.
Brad saw the flash of anger in Kossoff's eyes.
He took a deep, deliberate breath, then answered, But the responsibility is on my shoulders, Dr. Abbott. Those mission controllers back on Earth picked me to head this expedition. I make the decisions here, not a committee 200 light-years away.
Abbott stood his ground.
And you're willing to send this young man into grievous peril?
He's willing, said Kossoff.
Brad nodded.
Well, I admire your courage, Dr. McDaniels, although I doubt your sanity.
A few tentative chuckles broke out along the table.
Kossoff rapped his knuckles on the tabletop, then said, So it's settled. We send McDaniels to the surface of Gamma before its conjunction with Beta. We move this ship to orbit Alpha while the two planets go through their closest approach. Then we return to Gamma and pick up McDaniels when he's ready to return to us.